Thomas Keller is one of those chefs people speak of with awe. His restaurant, The French Laundry, is a place people dream about going, all of which inspires a few to make the trek to the little town of Yountville in Napa Valley and spend hundreds of dollars to dine there. But down the street is Keller's homier eatery called Ad Hoc. It offers family-style meals, no choices, whatever they're putting on the table that night. We've traveled to Ad Hoc to sample recipes from Thomas Keller's new cookbook, Ad Hoc at Home.
You gotta get some water, coffee, tea?
That would be Chef Keller showing the way into the kitchen, where he's going to prepare us a meal.
Cooks always love to be in the kitchen. I can't go to somebody's house and not help in the kitchen. I don't care if it's chopping parsley or peeling onions or whatever. It's part of my nature. I want to be in the kitchen.
Ad Hoc celebrates the foods Thomas Keller would have eaten as a kid. For a man made famous for dishes that are more like high art, Keller appreciates the power of the humblest of flavors.
Take ketchup, for example. The benchmark for ketchup in America is really Heinz. I remember years ago when chefs thought that they wanted to make their own ketchups in their restaurants, and you had this all these different ketchups that you had in restaurants. Nobody really liked it. Everybody wanted to get a bottle of Heinz. It's because we grew up on those flavors. Peanut butter. I mean, Skippy to me is what peanut butter should taste like. I know that maybe naturally ground peanuts into peanut butter may be better for me, but the Skippy is really that flavor that I'm looking for. So we have to really kind of respect some of those flavor profiles that we're dealing with.
And one of his most beloved flavor profiles is found in the wedge salad made of iceberg lettuce. Okay, when Thomas Keller makes it, he's slicing into baby iceberg, drizzled with a fresh buttermilk dressing. Some might call it ranch. It's a concoction Keller manages to whip up in just a few moments.
Okay. This is the salad, the iceberg lettuce salad with a buttermilk dressing. We're going to put blue cheese on it. I'm sorry, Roquefort. So this is Roquefort, French blue cheese. We have our bacon lardons, and we have croutons here, which are made from brioche. And then, of course, our Italian or flat-leaf parsley here that we're going to finish the garnish with.
Thomas Keller was raised in the 1960s by his working single mother. His father was a drill sergeant in the Marines. How did you eat as a kid?
I was the youngest of five boys. My parents were divorced when I was young. So basically, my older brothers cooked for me. And typically, they would eat as much as they wanted, whatever was left I got. So I really don't have any romantic, fond memories of, you know, sitting on my mother's knee or grandmother's knee stirring a pot of whatever. You know, mine was chili dogs and pizza and hamburgers and whatever my brothers felt like making.
Sounds like the worst possible preparation for becoming a chef, and a chef with a huge reputation.
Yeah. I think so. You know, my mother did run restaurants, and I was very fortunate to be able to go to those restaurants as a youngster and then ultimately work in them. And she had a very strong work ethic. She had an extraordinary attention to detail. And then I think I absorbed those qualities from her.
Big time. Celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain has described Thomas Keller's cooking as requiring a level of skill, diligence, and exactitude one would expect from a neurologist, which you see even in a simple recipe for chard, made with elegant leaves of rainbow chard. Keller's recipe calls for golden raisins steeped in white wine. He suggests a nice Sauvignon Blanc.
So we have our sauté pan here. We'll add some oil to it. And we want it to heat it up till it starts to shimmer, and just where we can see, you can just start to see the smoke coming off there now.
Oh,
see that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah,
now we're
definitely
ready to go.
And that's the chard going into the pan.
Sounds are very important in the kitchen as well, the way things sound in the pan.
You're doing what I do at home, but you're obviously not afraid to throw on the raw chard on top of chard that's been cooking.
Then we're going to cook it all long enough, and it's all going to have the same texture anyway. Now, can you smell that? I mean, it's just a wonderful aroma. So.
And while the rainbow chard is sizzling away, Keller turns to the main course, caramelized sea scallops.
Scallops I like to cook about medium rare to medium. They get well done. They get really chewy and a little tough.
As he talks, he's spooning very hot oil over the scallops, occasionally pressing his fingers to the top, testing for the firmness that signals they're ready.
I mean, those they're done. We have a little bit of finishing salt here. This is a fleur de sel. We want to add a little fleur de sel because not only is it going to add to the flavor, but it's also a textural thing.
There's an interesting combination, just watching you now, between
having everything very precise, the ingredients in their little dishes and whatnot, but also looseness with the food. I mean, are these personality traits in a certain sense?
I think they're personality traits now, but I was probably afraid of food in the beginning. I think people are intimidated by food. They're afraid to touch it. They're afraid to work with it. You know, me, I've become a tactile person. I love the way food feels. I'm not afraid to stick my hand in the pot with the sauteing scallops at a very high temperature and turn one over and feel it. And believe me, I've been burnt. But you learn by not being afraid, by not being intimidated by the food, just getting in there and enjoying it. So we can go have lunch.
Great. Sitting together at the table, Chef Thomas Keller muses on the meaning of sharing a meal and explains why he began this new cookbook with a recipe titled Dinner for Dad.
The sweet thing at the very beginning of the cookbook is you cooked him what turned out to be his last meal.
Of course, it's one of those things that happens, and in retrospect, you feel blessed that happened. You know, he wanted to have dinner at my house on Sunday night. You know, he asked me to make dinner for him. Okay, what do you want to eat? Well, I want a barbecue chicken. So I want to have strawberry shortcake. Those were some of his favorite things. You know, I went to the store to get everything. It was late spring, so there was, you know, we started to see the first strawberries, although they may not have been the best. He wanted strawberry shortcake. I saw collard greens, you know, and they were just compelling. They were beautiful, you know, so I picked up the collard greens and some bacon, and, you know, we braised off the collard greens. He loves mashed potatoes, and it was wonderful sitting on the back porch of my house, you know, at the grill there, doing barbecue chicken, having a what really was a all-American dinner, if you will. So it was a really an emotional moment for me in retrospect, because it turned out to be his last meal, and to be able to be part of that and actually give him something that brought back great memories for him. Because when you think about it, he had had barbecue chicken with strawberry shortcake countless times in his life. And when we have food like that, we remember those times. It's a very emotional thing. It's an emotional connection to who you are. And at the end of the day, cooking is about nurturing. It's about nurturing your family. For me, it's about nurturing our guests, you know, nurturing your loved ones. I mean, that's what it's really about. It's about giving somebody something that not only nourishes their body, of course, but also nourishes their spirit.
Thomas Keller, lunching with us at his family-style restaurant in Napa Valley. His new cookbook is called Ad Hoc at Home. And you can try the recipes you just heard, plus a recipe for brownies. Get them at npr.org.
Chef Evan Kleiman has a lot on her plate. That successful Los Angeles restaurant she runs, Angeli Cafe, an award-winning public radio program, a series of cookbooks, and now a whole lot of pie, more than 100 pies and counting, first on her blog, and now a contest that has Southern California rolling in dough. She joins us now from member station KCRW in Santa Monica. Evan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So what's the thing about you and pie?
Well, first of all, I love pie. And pie has sort of receded in the last few years. You know, I couldn't remember the last time I'd really made a beautiful double crust pie. So I thought at the beginning of the summer, why don't I make a pie a day? And so I figured the only way we'd actually do it was if I made a public announcement via the Good Food blog at KCRW, where my radio show is. And the next thing I know, it just blossomed into this sort of hidden community of pie hogs.
So what are some of the interesting things that you've come across?
During this quest?
Yeah, exactly. What recipe has come in on the blog or through the contest that just has made you go, gee, I never thought about that?
I guess for me, the most interesting part of this journey is how much there is to learn and how fiddly the little differences are. My best success happened with Alton Brown, the man behind the show Good Eats, who's known so much for his food science that he shares with everybody, but also just the way he fiddles with recipes until he gets it exactly how he wants it. And I learned, first of all, to use a sprayer to add my water to the dough instead of just drizzling it in, because if you add too much liquid to a pie dough, you'll get a lot of toughness, and you don't want that. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing he does was substitute fruit juice for part of the water. So, for example, if I'm making an apple pie, I will use apple juice concentrate, and it just lifts the flavor.
And now, how's this contest work?
Several weeks ago, we put up a form on our website, And any listener could decide what pie they wanted to enter and told us what they're going to bring. And we have 142 pies. Hopefully we're going to have a lot of eaters as well as contestants.
So what makes a good pie?
You know, that is such a personal thing. For me, it's all about excellent, beautiful farmers market fruit that has a ton of flavor tucked into the perfect crust that has enough of the flakiness to just really want me to fork in mouthful after mouthful.
You haven't been eating so much pie that it's, let me put this nicely, it's altered your appearance notably.
Well, I have to say that I'm not a lightweight, let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I was afraid
you're clearly a very thoughtful person.
I was afraid of what this pie would do to my appearance. But in fact, it turns out that if you have a slice of pie for breakfast, that you are good for the day and you're so satisfied that you don't feel you need to be bad. I mean, I don't like using that word, but you know what I mean.
You making anything special, a special pie for Thanksgiving? I mean, if you just say pumpkin.
No. Well, I'm going to do the Alton Brown double-crusted apple pie, which I just love so much. But I'm also doing an espresso chocolate pecan pie.
Oh, mercy. Well, I like that espresso part.
It just has a tiny bit of chunks of Belgian chocolate in it.
Oh, my word. A tiny chunk of Belgian chocolate could sink the Titanic. Well, good luck to you. Good eating.
Thank you so much.
Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food on member station KCRW in Santa Monica. And you can find out more about the pie contest on our blog, npr.org/soapbox.
I'm standing in a very warm, beautiful kitchen. Copper pots and frying pans hanging from the ceiling. Sunlight is pouring through the window. Bonnie Wolf, NPR's food essayist, is at the stove preparing a few dishes. This is her house near Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. And she's been kind enough to invite over the entire Weekend Edition team. Let's hear you. And we're all here because it's time for another edition of Calling All Chefs, a recurring Weekend Edition series where we ask you for your best recipes. Now, this time around, we asked for dishes that use ginger. Why ginger? Well, because this is my 20th anniversary, and I love ginger in all its forms. So let's get started. Bonnie, you've got a big green binder.
Recipes came from all over the country. A whole group of recipes came from an office in Minneapolis. Here's one from Louisville, Kentucky, Lewiston, Maine. There were almost 200 recipes. One person wrote, "The cookie jar at our parents' home wasn't right unless it contained these wonderful soft ginger snaps." And this person said she only found out the secret ingredient when her mother was on her deathbed.
Well, I want to thank you, first of all, for going through these recipes and trying them and tasting them. I mean, that's a real good sport to do this. So you picked, what, three?
Three.
That you think are going to satisfy my ginger jones here?
I certainly hope so. Okay.
I came hungry.
We are going to start with ginger butternut squash soup with an orange creme fraiche and topped by fried strips of orange and ginger.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay. I can smell the ginger. Mmm. This is very good. Very good.
You taste it.
I can taste the ginger. Yeah. I mean, it's nice because the butternut squash taste is about at the same level as the ginger. I'm not a real big fan of butternut squash, but this makes it taste really good. This is tasty. Who sent this in?
This was sent in by Dee Ferris from Richmond, California.
Okay. Next.
Salad. We have ginger orange pickled beets that were sent in by Joanna Graman of Stevenson, Washington.
I am someone who happens to like beets. I know there's a lot of people that don't, had bad childhood experiences
apparently
with them.
Apparently, some people in this room, but...
Raise your hands. Who's had a bad beet experience?
No.
Okay. They're good pickled beets, but I'm not really tasting ginger. I have a, it looks like I've got a piece right here, so. Yeah, that was definitely ginger.
But if it's not permeating the...
But I think you have to actually chew the ginger strip to be able to taste it.
The other things in it are, you cook the beets and then slice them about a quarter of an inch thick, mm-hmm. and cook, then cover them with rice wine vinegar, a little sugar, water, salt, black pepper, orange juice, garlic, a third of a sweet onion cut mm-hmm. into rings, and then an inch and a half of ginger root peeled with a potato peeler so it's thin, which is actually quite a lot of ginger.
Yeah, it is.
But I'm surprised that you really, unless you pick it up and put it with a piece of beet. I would have just taken all the ginger out and had ginger root with beet juice.
Okay.
Bonnie, maybe you can give us a little history of where ginger came from. I just know that I like it, but I don't know much about it.
Well, it's actually ancient. It was thought to have originated in Southeast Asia, but has been cultivated since ancient times, and it was apparently among the most highly prized of the Eastern imports to the Roman Empire. But they used it only for medicinal purposes. And then in England, in Anglo-Saxon times and in later medieval times, it was almost as common as pepper. But by the 18th century, it was mostly used in baked goods, which is how it's very often still used now. Now, dessert. This is a ginger pear upside down cake.
Are these Bosque pears?
They are. And they were specifically called for in this recipe, which was submitted by Kimberly Culbertson from Hillsboro, Oregon. And she says, this was inspired by my neighbors Celeste and Jory, who had a fantastic harvest of Bosque pears. They had so much, there was enough for them, us, their friends, and lots of others. It was a lovely gift, and we thank them.
It's creamy, but I'm not tasting the ginger.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
The batter has an inch of ginger root peeled and grated, mm-hmm. which is a goodly amount of ginger.
Yeah. I just got a quick taste, but it just came and went. But if you take a bite of the pear and a little whipped cream and a little cake and eat it, I would not know that there's ginger in here.
And I actually have a little something for you to have as an after. This was one of the many cocktails that was submitted. And this one came from Jessica Riley, who is a bartender in Chicago at a sushi bar. Mm-hmm. And she says she was informed by a few customers that she should submit her ginger martini recipe because it's simply amazing.
This is a ginger martini?
Mm-hmm.
That is nice. This, you can taste the ginger. I mean, straight out, you can taste the ginger. And then there's that nice lemon.
Lime juice, pineapple juice, triple sec, vodka, and ginger juice I squeezed myself, ooh. Which is why I'm naming this cut Leanne.
Labor intensive. Okay. My favorite is actually the ginger martini. That blew me away, right away, from the first sip. It just, yes, this is it. So,
well, it's pure ginger.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
And it's a little easier to make than the upside down cake and the beets and the soup. All very good. Thank you, everybody. But I have to say the ginger martini. Congratulations to Jessica Riley. We're going to call our winner.
Hi.
We've moved out of the kitchen to call our ginger recipe contest winner, Jessica Riley. She's a bartender at Mizu Yakitori in Chicago. So you came up with this drink. This is your drink and you put it on the menu?
Me and the owner kind of both did. We, in the beginning, we were using infused ginger vodka. And then one night we were really, really busy at work, and a lot of people were ordering the ginger martini. So we ran out of our infused, because we infused it ourselves with the ginger, but we went in the kitchen and asked the chef to get us some fresh ginger juice to use instead. The kick of the ginger was just more. You can taste the spiciness and then the sweetness of the drink also. It just went really well together.
It really did. But isn't that time-consuming work, getting ginger juice?
No, we leave that to the chef. We have tons and tons of ginger that we use because we're obviously a Japanese restaurant, so... Sure. We had tons of ginger, so...
Yeah. I can tell this is a big seller.
Yeah, it is. For people who love ginger, they they once they order one, they always order two, even if it's a Monday night.
Really? It was just absolutely delicious.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
We're all very proud of it at the restaurant. We have great food and we have great drinks, too. So.
Jessica Riley, she's the winner of our Calling All Chefs Ginger Contest, and she's a bartender at Mizu Yakitori in Chicago, Illinois. Thanks again, Jessica.
Thank you so much.
Special thanks to our food essayist, Bonnie Wolf, for going through all the recipes and having us over to her house. Most of the Weekend Edition staff was there and tried the recipes. You can see what dishes got their vote in a video on our blog, npr.org/soapbox. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.